Hello, this is William Fink, and this is Christigenia Internet Radio. Today is Friday, July 14th, 2023. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and thank you for listening. This evening, we are going to present part 21 of our commentary on Genesis, and it is titled, The Call of Abraham. The chronology of Genesis is quite important to us. Since if the chronology conflicts with ancient history, from things which we can know with certainty from archaeology and ancient records, then we cannot defend the historical validity of Genesis. But if we carefully piece together a chronology from biblical, archaeological, and historical sources, as we hope to have done here, then we may establish the fact that the biblical chronology does not conflict with ancient history, and therefore we can defend Genesis as being historical, so long as it is understood to be historical only within the context of the Adamic race, which is the white race. Doing that, we may also better understand the state of the world out of which Abraham had been called. So, in our last presentation here, the Tower of Babel, we hope to have demonstrated as facts both the date of the flood of Noah as having been several hundred years before the earliest records of the Sumerian language, and that there are no records of other languages which precede the division of languages described in Genesis chapter 11, an event which is stated to have happened in the days of Peleg. So our date for the flood, as best as we can reckon it, is about 3187 BC. The popular sources we have cited for the earliest appearance of the Sumerian language places it about 2900 BC. Our date for the life of Peleg is that he was born around the 2793rd year of Adam, and he died about the 3132nd year of Adam. This places his life, as we reckoned it, to have been from about 2656 to 2317 BC. And the popular sources date the earliest record of the Akkadian language to 2500 BC, very close to the middle of that period. And therefore, with all certainty, reflecting the truth of the statement that in his days was the earth divided, as we read in Genesis chapter 10, in verse 25. No other Western or Near Eastern languages are attested before these, in spite of conjecture concerning findings such as the so-called Vinca symbols or other ancient relics. However, concerning those things, we must also bear in mind that the Nephilim have an unbroken history in the Near East and in Anatolia, which is of far greater antiquity than that of any of the original Genesis chapter 10 Adamic nations. Apparently, what we know as Sumerian may also have been their language. The cities of Sumer and the Levant had various kings from among the Nephilim, such as Gilgamesh or Og of Bashan. We hope to discuss the presence of the Nephilim further when we encounter passages which mention them in Genesis chapters 14 and 15. As for our chronological thesis, we stated that the surest way to date these events, the flood and the dividing of the earth, was to calculate the year of the birth of Abram from the creation of Adam, and then to count backwards from the approximate date for the giving of the law at Sinai. So according to Paul of Tarsus in Galatians chapter 3, there were 430 years from the call of Abram and his receiving of the promises preceding the date of the Exodus and the giving of the law at Sinai. And then there were the first 75 years of Abram's life before which he had received those promises. So, if we estimate the date of the Exodus to 1450 BC, which is not perfect, but which is certainly within reason, then counting back 430 years, we can see that Abram was called by Yahweh about 1880 BC. And he was born 75 years before that, which is 1955 BC. According to that reckoning, if the Exodus was 1450 BC, which is close enough, and if he was born in the 3494th year of Adam, as we have determined here from the Septuagint chronology, then that year must be 1955 BC. Matching 1955 BC to the number of years after Abram was born after Adam, we can deduce earlier dates, such as that of the flood and also of the lifespan of Peleg, which we have already proposed here. To establish 1450 as an approximate date for the Exodus, I am now going to cite a few passages from my commentary on Paul's Epistle to the Hebrews, where I had last discussed the subject at length. First, from part 14 of my Hebrews commentary, titled The Faith of History, which was presented here on December 23rd, 2016. I said, with this, there are many scoffers who try to dispute whether the children of Israel were ever slaves in Egypt for, quote-unquote, 400 years, as the Judaized denominational Christians claim. First, discussing Genesis chapter 3 here some 16 months ago. I'm sorry, Galatians chapter 3 here. I'm quoting myself from 2016. First, discussing Galatians chapter 3 here some 16 months ago, we determined that Paul had reckoned a period of 430 years from the call of Abram to the giving of the law at Sinai. Of that period, it is determined from Scripture that there were about 215 years from the call of Abraham to the time when Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. And from then, the children of Israel were actually in Egypt for the next 215 years. Originally as guests, where they could not have been held in bondage for more than 200 years. For more than about 200 years, I may have written. In our Galatians presentation, which was probably from 2015, we elucidated the corroborating evidence for all of this from the genealogies and other aspects of Scripture. As it is explained in both Exodus chapter 6 and 1 Chronicles chapter 6, Moses was only the fourth generation from Levi, the line of descent being Levi, Kohath, Amram, and then Moses. So Moses was only the second generation of those born in Egypt, as Kohath was already born and among those who had gone to Egypt with Jacob. If Moses was 80 at the time of the Exodus, which is apparent, and if the patriarchs were still having their sons at the age of 70, which was the case with Abram's grandfather, Terah, even then, no more than 220 years could possibly have elapsed from the time when Jacob went to Egypt to the time of the Exodus. So in that manner, we establish our calculation of 215 years in that 2016 presentation in Hebrews, with which we shall now continue where I had written. Furthermore, in our presentation of Acts chapters 6 and 7, given here over 3 years ago, which has now been over 10 years ago, We illustrated that the entire period of that 200 years of captivity was during the time of the 18th dynasty, where we wrote the following. So now I'm citing my Hebrews commentary, but my Hebrews commentary cites my old Acts commentary from 2013. And I wrote, regardless of the mainstream academic contentions over the Pharaoh and the time of the Exodus, which generally place it in the 19th dynasty and at the time of Ramses, both the testimony of Josephus and an honest study of the chronology of the period tells us that an 18th dynasty pharaoh named Thutmose, whom Josephus calls Thutmosis, was the pharaoh of the time of the Exodus. There were four pharaohs by this name, and they were all related. Thutmose I and Thutmose II were the third and fourth pharaohs of this dynasty, the 18th dynasty. Hatshepsut was fifth, and it is very likely she who drew Moses out of the water, thereby giving him a form of her family name. The sixth and eighth pharaohs of this dynasty were Thutmose III and Thutmose IV. The death of one more Thutmose, who never became pharaoh, led to the ascension of his brother, Akhenaten. It was during the reign of Akhenaten that the Amarna letters were written. These archaeological relics were written to Akhenaten by various kings of the land of Canaan, and in them it is apparent that they had beseeched him for protection from the invading Hebrews. When I made that presentation, I did not have a copy of Manetho, the earlier historian whom Flavius Josephus had cited, so I thought to obtain one. Manetho was mentioned by Josephus in many places in regard to Egyptian history. So presenting part 15 of our Hebrews commentary, which was titled Sons or Bastards, a week later on December 30th, I wrote the following. Furthermore, discussing Paul's description of Moses and the events of the Exodus, we elucidated the fact that five ancient historians, four of them pagans, had accepted the accounts of Moses and the Exodus as being historical in nature. Three of these are Flavius Josephus, a Judean, and the pagan Greek writers Strabo of Cappadocia and Diodorus Siculus, both of whom wrote before the time of Christ. None of these witnesses were Christians, and none of them, not even Josephus, were what we may fairly consider to be Jewish. Then from Josephus, we saw that a pagan Egyptian writer of the 3rd century BC, named Manetho, also accepted Moses and the Exodus account as being historical, and correctly dated it to the pharaohs of the 18th dynasty. Finally, through Diodorus Siculus, we saw that another pagan Greek writer in Egypt named Hecataeus of Abdera had also accepted the accounts of Moses and the Exodus as being historical, although the version of the Exodus account given by Hecataeus was more accommodating to the Egyptians. Now we can say that so was the version given by Manetho, which is something that Josephus had overlooked. He probably simply ignored it in incorporating Manetho's history into his own. Since our previous presentation in the series, meaning that first part of our Hebrews commentary, which we had cited here in part, we have acquired a copy of the Loeb Library volume of the Fragments of Manetho, which was first published in 1940. While almost all of Manetho's original work is now lost, the fragments of his writing which survive show that other ancient writers had also cited him regarding his accounts of the Exodus. Theophilus of Antioch, a Christian of the late 2nd century AD, in an apologetic work entitled Apology to Autolycus, or Autolycus, had cited Manetho and wrote that Moses was the leader of the Judeans, using the Greek word found in all of the Hellenistic writings. As I have already said, when they had been expelled from Egypt by King Pharaoh, whose name was Thutmosis. After the expulsion of the people, this king, it is said, reigned for 25 years and 4 months, according to Manetho's reckoning. So we see, and I'm still citing that old Hebrews commentary, so we see in this two things which Josephus did not provide for us in his own citations of Manetho. First, that Manetho's version of the Exodus account had the same perspective favorable to the Egyptians, which we had seen in the account given by Hecataeus of Abdera that was cited by Diodorus Siculus. Secondly, and just as importantly, the account of the number of the years in the reign of Thutmose corroborates our assertion that Manetho must have referred to Thutmose III, the only pharaoh with the name who had reigned for so long a time. By the popular accounts, Thutmose III ruled Egypt for nearly 55 years until 1425 BC. So where Manetho informs us that Thutmose lived 25 years after the Exodus, our chronology of the period and our approximate dating of the event to 1450 BC are once again fully vindicated. That's why I anchor this whole chronology to that Exodus of 1450 BC and to Paul's statement that Abraham received the promises 430 years before that. The law given at Sinai was the same year as the Exodus. It only happened actually maybe a month or so later, maybe even only weeks later. My memory fails me, but it's not long at all. The fact that all of these ancient writers had accepted an Egyptian version of Moses and the Exodus also helped serve to prove that the Exodus was indeed a historical event, regardless of which perspective one may choose to believe, the biblical or the Egyptian. The fact that it happened sometime around 1450 BC also agrees with the mention of the invading Habiri, or Hebrews, by certain of the rulers of city-states in Canaan in the Amarna letters, which date to the rule of Pharaoh Akhenaten, who ruled Egypt for about 18 years, from about 1353 or 1351 BC. In the intervening 100 years, the children of Israel wandered 40 years in the Arabian desert, spent several more years in their journeys during which they fought many battles east of the Jordan, and established themselves on the plains of Moab for at least several years before finally invading Canaan at Jericho. Then, after they invaded, the process of occupying the land was gradual and took many decades. So with this, we should discern that the invasion of Canaan by Israel, which the scripture also describes as a gradual process, was also historical. When we publish this presentation of Christogenia, we will present a chart with this chronology of Genesis, from Adam through the time of the call of Abram, which improves on a similar chart which had been made by Clifton Emmaheiser. Clifton did not include the popular reckoning of years BC in his chart, or information such as the time of the flood or the division of nations. In our last presentation, we also noted that our dates for the births of the patriarchs from Shem forward differ with those of Clifton by 2 years. This is because when he made his chronology, Clifton merely used the date calculated by the statement that Noah was 500 years old and Noah begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth, which is found in the final verse of Genesis chapter 5. However, from other statements in Genesis, we demonstrated that Japheth was the eldest of Noah's sons, and seeing the age of Shem after the flood with the birth of Arphaxad, it is apparent that Shem was 2 years younger than Japheth, and he was most likely born in the 502nd year of the life of Noah rather than the 500th, which is when his older brother was born. This we had explained at length in the closing paragraphs of our presentation on the book of the race of Adam. I believe that was the entirety of Genesis chapter 5, I think. At the end of the Tower of Babel presentation, we hastily calculated the date for the flood at 3183 BC. However, that date shall be corrected here to 3187 BC. I do not remember what may have caused me to err, but 4 years are insignificant on a biblical timescale. Perhaps I was using a 1454 date for the Exodus, which may or may not be more accurate, and which is found in some other sources. Concluding that last presentation, we left off in Genesis chapter 11 with the birth of Peleg and his own first son, Reu, or as it is in the Septuagint, Ragah, I don't know why, R-A-G-A-U. So we shall repeat those verses here. From verse 16 of Genesis chapter 11. And Eber lived 430 years and begat Peleg. And Eber lived after he begat Peleg 430 years and begat sons and daughters. And Peleg lived 30 years and begat Reu. And Peleg lived after he begat Reu 209 years and begat sons and daughters. In the Septuagint account, Eber was born when Salah was 130 years old, not 30. And that is the 2659th year of Adam. Peleg was born when Eber was 134 years old, according to the Septuagint, and not 34, which is the 2793rd year of Adam. According to our method of tying this chronology to 1450 BC, which may be off by a handful of years, but which is sufficient for our purposes, Peleg lived from about 2656 BC to 2317 BC. And as we read in Genesis chapter 10, in the days of Peleg, the nations were divided. So our chronology will reckon that division at the midway point in the life of Peleg to about 2486 BC. The division was probably a long process and may have begun several centuries earlier, but it must have been completed by about that time. According to the Septuagint, Reu was born when Peleg was 130 years old, in the 2923rd year of Adam. So now we shall proceed with Genesis chapter 11. And Reu lived 230 years and begot Serug. And Reu lived after he begot Serug 207 years and begot sons and daughters. The name Reu, or Rau, R-A-U, it should be transliterated, in my opinion, is defined by Strong's as friend. It is related to Rhea and other similar words, which may also mean companion or associate. This last word, Rhea, was translated as neighbor in Leviticus 19:18, chapter 19, verse 18, and elsewhere. Although in that passage, the word neighbor is defined as one of the children of one's own people. I should say it is equated to one of the children of one's own people. That's a proper neighbor. The root verb is rea, which is defined by Strong's at number 7462 as to tend a flock, i.e. pasture it, where it is apparent that one's friend is someone of one's own flock. The name Serug, or Sherug, is from a verb which means to entwine, and Strong's defines it as tendril, like the shoots of a climbing plant, that these tendrils allow the plant to entwine itself around a tree or some other structure. So there are lessons for proper society, even in the names of these patriarchs, that one should be entwined with one's friends, with one's own people. According to the Septuagint, Ru was 130 years old when Serug was born. So here it is, the 3055th year of Adam, or 2394 BC. With the birth of Salah and the reckoning of Canaan, the discrepancy with the Masoretic text had grown to 936 years. Adding to that the differences in the ages of the patriarchs Salah, Heber, Peleg, and Reu, when their eldest sons were first born, that difference widens to 1,336 years. And Serug lived 30 years and begot Nahor. And Serug lived after he begot Nahor 200 years and begot sons and daughters. And the name Nahor is related to a verb by Strong's, Nakar, which is defined as to snore or snort, perhaps. And this isn't in my notes, but perhaps it should be snore, because when you entwine yourself with your friends as associates with the people of your own race, you'll have rest. That's my opinion. I just had to make that observation. But once again, the Septuagint has 130 years as the age of Serug when he begot Nahor. So Nahor was born in the 3185th year of Adam, or about 2264 BC. The discrepancy with the chronology of the Masoretic text is now 1,436 years. And Nahor lived 29 years and begot Terah. And Nahor lived after he begot Terah 119 years and begot sons and daughters. The name Terah, or Terach is more appropriate, is not defined by Strong's. However, Genesis wrote that it comes from an, Jesenius wrote that it comes from an unused root word, meaning a word which was not used in Scripture, which means delay. Spelled Tara, T-A-R-A-H, in the King James Version, it is the name of one of the stops of the children of Israel as they wandered in the desert following the Exodus in Numbers chapter 33. Verse 27. According to the Septuagint, Nahor begot Terah when he was 179 years old, in the 3364th year of Adam, or 2085 BC. The discrepancy with the chronology of the Masoretic text is now 1,586 years. So even without the 130-year interpolation of Canaan, for which we have followed the Septuagint and the Gospel of Luke, the discrepancy would still be nearly 1,500 years, 1,456 years. That is a significant difference when attempting to reconcile the Bible to what we may know of ancient history, and nearly every Judeo-Christian commentator makes the primary mistake of following the Masoretic text chronology in this regard. Even Bertrand Comparé and many other Christian identity pastors had followed the Masoretic chronology in many of their sermons, Comparé in many of his sermons. But this will be our last comment here on the differences in the chronologies. unless for some unforeseeable reason it is necessary to do so later in Genesis. However, we hope to have demonstrated that an examination of the ages of the patriarchs helps us to understand Genesis and properly relate it to both history and archaeology. Verse 26. And Terah lived 70 years and begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And here we have a situation similar to that of Noah, where the final passage in Genesis chapter 5 merely says that Noah was 500 years old when he begot Shem, Ham, and Japheth. But Noah only began to have his children at 500 years. And here, Terah only began to have his children at 70 years, which is also 70 years in the Septuagint as well as in the Masoretic text. Moreover, Abram is the youngest of these three sons, and we must turn to other scriptures to determine more precisely the time when he was born. In the final verse of this chapter, we read that Terah died after he and his family, including Abram, had gone to Haran from Ur of the Chaldees. He was 205 years old when he died. After that, Abram was called by Yahweh to leave Haran. And in Genesis chapter 12, verse 4, we read that he was 75 years old when he received that call. His father was already dead at 205 when Abraham was 75. So Abraham certainly couldn't have been born when his father was 70. Since we cannot determine how long it was between the time when Terah died and the time when Abraham departed Haran, we can only use those ages and deduct 75 from 205 to determine that Terah was about 130 years old when Abram was born. Abram may have been a little older if he had been kept at Haran for any significant time after his father died. Terah may have been a little older when Abram was born. If Abram had been kept at Haran for any significant time after his father died. But from the text, we cannot tell whether or not he was. So we have to assume that this figure is somewhat accurate. Therefore, with Terah having been at least 130 years old when Abram was born, then Abram was born around the 3,494th year of Adam, or about 1955 BC. In a commentary on Genesis, found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, we read the following, in part. Terah was 140 years old when he left Ur of the Chaldees and went to Haran, and Abram was 70 years old. And Abram dwelt 5 years in Haran. Then Terah died 60 years after Abram went out to the land of Canaan. I don't know how they got that from Genesis. That's a late commentary on Genesis. There are all different types of documents found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that commentary belongs ostensibly to the first century sect which authored the Dead Sea Scrolls. This we must reject, as it suggests that Abram was 70 years old when his father was only 145 years old. And that conflicts with the account of their ages, as well as the general narrative here in Genesis. In the final passages of this chapter of Genesis, it is clear that Abram already took a wife and was at like age with Nahor, who also took a wife around the same time. But that his brother Haran was much older than either of them, as he already had grown children by the time that his brothers took wives. So Haran was the oldest son of Terah, and Nahor and Abram were born much later. Therefore, it is fully apparent as we have already explained, that Terah was at least 130 years old when Abram was born. If Abram spent 5 years in Haran after Terah died, then Terah would have been 135 years old when Abram was born. But we must work under the presumption that he was 130, because any addition of years, even if it is evident that there should be one, can only be grounded in conjecture. Abraham's call in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, could have been 2 weeks after Terah died, or it could have been 5 years or longer after Terah died. The longer it was, then the older Terah must have been when Abraham was born. But we have to assume 130. We can't just make up a figure and imagine that to be the span of time between the last verse in chapter 11 and the first verse in chapter 12. That's just conjecture. It's silly. Now, these are the generations of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And Haran begot Lot. And Haran died before his father Terah in a land of his nativity, in Ur of the Chaldees. Abram's brother Nahor has the same name as his grandfather. Abram, who is apparently the youngest of the sons here, is mentioned first because it is he who is chosen to carry on the Adamic family line in preference over his brothers. The name Abram means high father or exalted father. Just as Shem was placed in order before the elder Japheth and given a name which means name in the sense of distinguished or famed, Abraham's given name of Abram was also prophetic of the role which he was destined to fulfill in history. Since whether modern white Europeans know it or not, and of course most of them don't know it, the day is coming that they will indeed know that Abraham is the father of their race, just as Paul of Tarsus had also explained in Romans chapter 5. Here is the first time that Ur of the Chaldees, or properly Ur of the Kasdim, the Kassites, is mentioned in Scripture. The ancient city of Ur was on the west bank of the Euphrates, just opposite ancient Sumer in lower Mesopotamia. It is not necessarily the land of Terah's nativity, but Terah must have been there for quite some time, since his eldest son Haran was born there, and therefore Nahor and Abram were also very likely born there. Verse 29. And Abram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife, Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no child. Sarai is actually said to mean princess, but I have not looked at it from authoritative sources. I thought to hold it for later until the time when her name is changed to Sarah. Here it is evident that Haran was the eldest son of Terah, since Haran already has several grown children, namely Lot, Milcah, and Iscah, while Nahor and Abram are just now taking their wives. But we are not told explicitly the name of the father of Sarai, or Sarai, I should say, S-A-R-A-I, who later becomes known as Sarah. The word for daughter used here to describe Milcah is singular and does not describe Sarai. So she was evidently not a daughter of Haran, and neither could she have been a daughter of Nahor, as he had also just taken a wife. It is also plausible that Terah had more than one wife, and even that Nahor and Abram are sons of a wife other than the mother of Haran, since Haran is as many as 60 years older than Abram. This is not incredible, since Abraham himself had children at an advanced age with Keturah long after the birth of Isaac. Perhaps it is plausible that Sarai was the daughter of yet another wife. And I know I can't make my mind up how I want to pronounce this word, Sarai, Sarai. Sarai, I should just call her. It's plausible that she was the daughter of yet another wife. But that, and anything else which may be imagined, is only conjecture. I have purposely ignored several apocryphal accounts here, which are late and which are not credible either. Sarai was only 10 years younger than Abram when they were married, according to the narrative which is provided in later chapters of Genesis, where she is described as having been 90 when Abraham was 100. Certain apocryphal books engage in other conjectures as to her identity. Other sources identify Sarah with the Iscah mentioned here in this verse, but that is also conjecture. Here it is also evident that Haran was named, that is also conjecture and actually is refuted by the verse itself. Here it is also evident that Haran was named after a word which was similar to the name of the city in which his father and brothers sought to settle after his death. So perhaps Terah was originally from Haran in Paddan Aram. If that is not true, then for some otherwise unknown reason, after the death of Haran, Terah decided to settle in Paddan Aram. When Abram later leaves Haran, Nahor stays behind, and his descendants in Paddan Aram provide wives for Isaac and Jacob in subsequent generations. This move to Haran is sometime around or not long before Abraham's 75th year, verse 31 of Genesis chapter 11. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran his son's son, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there. And I'm purposely trying to pronounce the name of Abraham's brother as Haran and the name of the place in Paddan Aram as Haran. And popular modern spellings spell it with two R's, but there's only one R in Hebrew. The Hebrew word for the given name Haran, or Haran, is H-R-N, Hey Resh Nun, while the Hebrew word for the place name, Haran, is C-H-R-N, it's Het Resh Nun, the Hey character in the Hebrew alphabet is a different character, even though it's very, very similar in appearance than the Het character. And the Het character should almost certainly be pronounced as a hard CH, while the He character should be pronounced simply as an H. The King James translators and a lot of other modern translators continually use simply an H for either of those characters. So that's also a source of great confusion. Biblical Haran, which is now generally spelled with two R's, is in northwestern Mesopotamia, in what is now modern Turkey, about 55 miles east of the Euphrates River. 92 miles east and slightly south of the modern Turkish city of Gaziantep, and just over 110 miles northeast of the modern Syrian city of Aleppo, And I'm going to backtrack a little because I skipped a few lines in the last paragraph, distracting myself. The word Haran, the name of the city, would have been much better spelled as Charan in English, C-H-A-R-A-N, because it begins with the het and not with the he or ha. Strong's defines the name Haran as mountaineer, and the name of the place, Charan, as meaning parched. Jesenius agrees with both of those Strong's definitions. In the Septuagint, when this verse was translated, this verse, Genesis 11, chapter 11, verse 31, was translated in the Septuagint, the words were distinguished in that same manner in this passage in the Septuagint, where Haran, or Haran, I should say, is spelled Aaron, A-R-R-A-N, in Greek, but the name of the city, Charan, or Charan, is spelled with the key, which is C-H-A-R-R-A-N. So the Septuagint Greek is better than the King James Version in that respect. Very often, actually. Haran, the city, is very close to the eastern edge of the region generally known as Paddan Aram, or Aram Naharaim, the portion of Aram which is between the rivers, because Paddan Aram was in northern Mesopotamia, north of Assyria, or I should say north of what later became known as Assyria. In scripture, Haran, of course, was evidently considered to be a part of that region. Later, in Genesis chapter 28, where Jacob was gone to Paddan Aram in verse 7, he went toward Haran in verse 10. So Haran was considered to be in Paddan Aram. When he arrived, Jacob said to certain men, as the King James Version has it in Genesis chapter 29, "My brethren, whence be ye?" And they answered, "Of Haran we are," in verse 4 of that chapter. So it seems that Jacob had recognized these men as Hebrews, calling them his brethren. That is very plausible. It is also safe to conclude that while Terah may have sojourned in Ur of the Chaldees for a long time, and that is where his son Haran was born, and evidently also Abram himself, that his kin were originally Hebrews from the mountainous areas to the north and from the plain of Aram or Paddan Aram. For that reason, we read of Jacob in Deuteronomy chapter 26 that a Syrian ready to perish was my father. And he went down into Egypt and sojourned there with a few and became there a nation great, mighty, and populous. It is difficult to know otherwise who the early occupants of Haran were, outside of the fact that Abraham's own son and his descendants had dwelt there for at least several generations. Abraham's own brother and his descendants had dwelt there for at least several generations and down through the time of Jacob. Probably longer than that, but we don't know because after Genesis chapter 31, they also disappear from the narrative of scripture. According to popular sources, both Ur of the Chaldees, Ur Kasdim, and Haran had very ancient temples to the moon god Sin, which have been discovered by archaeologists and which suggests even stronger links between the two cities. The final clause of Genesis chapter 11. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And this concludes Genesis chapter 11. And as we have explained, unless there is this substantial but unprovided space of time between the events of Terah's death and the call of Abraham to depart from Haran in the very next verse in chapter 12, then Terah must have been 130 years old when his son Abraham was born. I don't know how it is going to translate into HTML when I post this presentation at Christogenia. At this point, after the end of Genesis chapter 11, at this point in the written edition of this presentation, there is a chart which follows, which reflects the patriarchal ages and dates which we have calculated from the Septuagint. Now, there is also going to be a link to this chart where I first mentioned it earlier this evening, and the chart may be downloaded from that link. It'll be in the text. This chart, I'm only going to mention a few highlights from it. It's very much like the ones that were posted long ago that I had posted for Clifton Emmaheiser at his website when I created it back in 2009. But it adds a few columns. It adds a column for the birth and death years of each of the patriarchs, calculated in years BC according to the method that I have presented here. And basically, it dates the flood to 3187 BC and the birth of Peleg to 2656 BC. So for that reason, the midpoint in Peleg's life, we account as the time by which the division of the nations and the languages was completed around 2046 BC. The birth of Abraham in 1955 BC. The call of Abraham in 1880 BC. The birth of Isaac in 1855. The birth of Jacob in 1795. Jacob's going to Egypt at age 130 in 1665, and the giving of the law at Sinai in 1450 BC. So they are the items on a chart from the creation of Adam to the giving of the law. Now, before we commence with Genesis chapter 12, and we will only discuss a few verses, first we shall give a summary of a few important dates from this chronology, and I have already done this, so I'm not going to repeat it. I got ahead of myself once again and scrolled down the page and realized I wrote this, but what I wrote in my paragraph, in that paragraph, pretty much is what I had just said. Jacob went to Egypt about 1665 BC, shortly after which the book of Genesis comes to a close. And the Exodus occurred 215 years later. So for half of that 430 years that Paul mentioned in Galatians, basically 215 years of it is from the call of Abraham to Jacob going to Egypt. The children of Israel were not in captivity for 400 years. The Judeo-Christian interpretations of Scripture are usually very overwhelmingly or very oversimplified, I should say. They're not only oversimplified, they're just plain simplistic and stupid. And that's why so many people become disenchanted with the churches, especially if they ever read anything serious about history. And the Antichrist Jew is constantly exploiting these oversimplified Judeo-Christian interpretations of Scripture in order to discredit Scripture, and with that, to discredit and undermine Christianity. The children of Israel were not slaves in Egypt for 400 years, and nowhere does it say that in Scripture, even though it mentions that 400-year period, the interpretations are far oversimplified. And they're just wrong. The chronology is very clear. They were slaves in Egypt for less than 215 years. And actually for only two generations. The generation after Kohath, in which Amram was born, the father of Moses, and then the generation of Moses in which he was born, and then for about two more generations until Moses delivered the children of Israel from Egypt by the power of Yahweh, of course. So they were not slaves for more than a handful of generations. So with this, it is also evident that there were about 700 years between the flood and the division of the nations, during which the events which are described in Genesis chapter 11 had unfolded. Then from there, it is perhaps another 600 or so years before the call of Abraham. And there is nothing in Scripture which informs us as to what was transpiring during most of that quite lengthy period of time. Now we shall commence with Genesis chapter 12. I should say, what was transpiring in the wider world. Now we shall commence with Genesis chapter 12 and the call of Abram. Now Yahweh had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country, and from thy kindred, and from thy father's house, unto a land which I will show thee. And the wording here also helps to establish that the inhabitants of Haran may indeed have been Hebrews, thy kindred, and from thy father's house. Well, Nahor would have been a member of his father's house, so that word kindred should be interpreted in a wider sense, just as Jacob, when he arrived and saw these strange men, called them brethren, he must have identified them as Hebrews, men even of various branches of essentially the same race at that time, were usually identified by their customs of dress, whether or not they had earrings and things like that. And I believe that the Midianites are identified later in scriptures having had earrings and were identified on that basis because they wore a particular earring. I believe it was the Midianites and not the Ishmaelites. I'm sure it was the Midianites, but I won't find a passage on the fly, that's for sure. So, in regard to this first verse of Genesis chapter 12, the Adamic society of the time, which was about 1880 BC, was entirely corrupted. The Akkadian Empire had already collapsed, actually about 150 years earlier, and Canaanite kingdoms, such as those of the Hittites and the Hurrian Mitanni, were in the process of becoming powerful empires, which would compete with Egypt and subject Assyria and the rest of Mesopotamia, the Levant, and Anatolia for some centuries. The Amorites had established themselves at Babylon and had begun to develop their own empire only two decades before the call of Abraham. And that may have been a reason for Terah's having moved to Paddan Aram. But perhaps about a century or so later, Haran and the rest of Paddan Aram would also be ruled by Canaanites, becoming subject to the Mitanni kingdom. When we discuss verse 5 of this chapter, we hope to explain the plausible circumstances for why Yahweh had Abram settle at Bethel, although there were also Canaanites there. But we cannot ever know why Yahweh chose Abram as the vessel by which he would preserve his creation. As Paul of Tarsus had explained at length, Abram was deemed righteous because he believed God in Romans chapter 4. But that belief could only follow after God had already chosen him. And we're not told for what reason he had already chosen him. There in that chapter, Paul had written, "Now, what may we say that our forefather Abraham has found concerning the flesh?" I'm citing the Christogenean New Testament here. "For if Abraham, from the rituals, has been deemed worthy, he has reason to boast, but not towards Yahweh. Indeed, what did the writing say? That Abraham trusted Yahweh, and it was accounted to him for righteousness." Paul arguing that Abraham was not deemed righteous because of doing any rituals. A little later in the passage, Paul wrote, "And he received a sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith he had in uncircumcision, in regard to his being the father of all those who are believing, in a state of uncircumcision, for them also to be accounted that righteousness. And a father of circumcision, to those not from circumcision only, but to those who walk in the footsteps of the faith our father Abraham had in uncircumcision." Ostensibly, and this is so easily taken out of context, ostensibly the faith in which Abraham had walked is another expression of the fact that Abraham had believed God. He merely believed the words which Yahweh had told him here in these first three verses of Genesis chapter 12. And the proof of his belief is the fact that he immediately acted on those words, as it is described in verse 4 of this chapter. This must be all Abraham had believed, since there was nothing else which was provided him by Yahweh for him to believe, or which would cause him to believe. Therefore, the faith of Abraham, for which he was accredited as having been righteous, was simply that he believed what Yahweh had told him in verses 1 through 3 of this chapter of Genesis, and everything which follows is predicated only upon that, or perhaps I should have written upon that alone. Until this time, it is evident that Abram was a pagan, since his fathers and his brothers were pagans. This we read in Joshua chapter 24. "And Joshua said unto all the people, Thus saith Yahweh God of Israel, Your fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in old time, even Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods." The flood in that passage is a reference to the Euphrates River, since Haran is north of that river from Palestine to the south. Further proof that Nahor and his descendants were pagan is in the episode of the household gods of Laban, which were stolen from him by his daughter Rachel, whom Jacob had married when he left the house of Laban with his daughters to take them to Canaan. As the account goes in Genesis chapter 31, when he realized his household gods were missing, Laban had pursued and caught up with Jacob on the road. But Rachel hid the gods so that they could not be found, and Jacob did not know that she had taken them. The possession of these idols was so important to Laban that before he was compelled to return without them, he asked Jacob to make an oath never to come north in order to harm him, and Jacob agreed. Then the two parted ways, and the idols which Rachel had stolen fell out of the narrative of Scripture. However, in the course of that event, as it is described in verse 32 of the chapter, Laban, Rachel's father, had made another oath where he said, "With whomsoever thou findest thy gods, let him not live. A short time later, Rachel died prematurely after giving birth to her second child, Benjamin. In an Akkadian legal document discovered at the site of ancient Nuzi in northern Mesopotamia, the other side of Padanaram from Haran, we read the following in part. This is titled 2, Sale Adoption. It's the second sale adoption mentioned on this legal document. The tablet of adoption belonging to Nashwi, the son of Arshani. He adopted Wulu, the son of Puhi-Sheni. As long as Nashwi is alive, Wulu shall provide food and clothing. When Nashwi dies, Nashwi was evidently elderly and couldn't any longer work, so Wulu was assuming the role of an eldest son. When Nashwi dies, Wulu shall become the heir. If Nashwi has a son of his own, I guess he had high hopes in his elderly years, he shall divide the estate equally with Wulu. But the son of Nashwi shall take the gods of Nashwi. However, if Nashwi does not have a son of his own, then Wulu shall take the gods of Nashwi. Furthermore, he gave his daughter, Nuhoya, in marriage to Wulu. And if Wulu takes another wife, he shall forfeit the lands and buildings of Nashwi. Whoever defaults shall make compensation with 1 mina of silver and 1 mina of gold. In a footnote for that passage in ancient Near Eastern texts, we read the following. Possession of the household gods marked a person as the legitimate heir, which explains Laban's anxiety in Genesis chapter 31, verse 26 forward, to recover his household gods from Jacob. It is to be noted, too, that Laban binds Jacob in verse 50 to marry no other wives besides his daughters, just as Wulu is bound in our text. In other words, that inscription perfectly describes the dilemma of the household gods and the relationship between Laban and Jacob in Genesis chapter 31. Without a doubt, we agree with the conclusions made in that footnote. But our purpose for repeating it here is only to show that the descendants of Nahor, Abram's brother, were pagans just as well as Abram's fathers had been pagans, which we see is attested in Joshua chapter 24. Abram would have been raised holding the same general beliefs as his father and his brothers. However, for some unexpressed reason, he was chosen by Yahweh, and that reason is not explicitly revealed in Scripture. Verse 2 of Genesis chapter 12. And I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. As we have already said, that name Abram, which Abraham had already been given at birth, means exalted father in Hebrew. Here, the promise of God ensures that Abram would indeed live up to that name. There is one more promise in verse 3. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curses thee. And in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. In the understanding which Abraham must have had at that time, the only understanding that a man in his historical context could have had, the reference to all the families of the earth could only have been a reference to the other Genesis chapter 10 nations of the surrounding lands. In Genesis chapter 10, only two chapters prior to this promise, we read of the sons of Noah in verse 32. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations in their nations, and by these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. Once again, the word translated as earth here means land, and in Scripture, it cannot possibly ever refer to the entire planet or to anyone who is from outside of the context of the book of Genesis. Whatever traditions may have come down from the more ancient patriarchs may be reflected in those paganized versions of the myths of creation and antiquity, which are found in the many extant Mesopotamian tablets and inscriptions, but it cannot be assumed that they reflect the full beliefs of all of the Genesis 10 families, many of whom are not represented in surviving inscriptions, nor had beliefs that were ever represented in surviving inscriptions. While Abram could only have understood this promise in the context of his own time, in the understanding of Paul of Tarsus, looking at the Genesis account through Christian eyes, the reference to all the families of the earth was a prophetic statement which referred to the future 12 tribes of Israel, the descendants of Jacob who inherited the promise to Abraham that his seed would inherit the earth. This is what Paul had meant where he wrote in Galatians chapter 3, that just as Abraham had trusted Yahweh, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, then you know that they from faith, they are sons of Abraham. And the writing having foreseen that from faith Yahweh would deem the nations righteous, announced to Abraham beforehand that in you shall all the nations be blessed. So those from faith are blessed along with the believing Abraham. Yet when Paul mentioned they from faith, he must have meant they from of the faith of Abraham. And the promise which Abraham had believed is the substance of that faith, that I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee and make thy name great. So it can't be speaking of any people outside of Abraham's own descendants. Paul explains this further in Romans chapter 4, where he wrote, indeed, not through the law is the promise to Abraham or to his offspring, that he is to be the heir of the society, but through righteousness of faith. Then further on, Paul defines the substance of that faith and wrote, therefore, from of the faith, that in accordance with favor, then the promise is to be certain to all of the offspring, not to that of the law only, but also to that of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all, just as it is written. Abraham isn't appointed as the honorary father over alien peoples. Paul wrote here, just as it is written, that's how he's the father of us all, that a father of many nations I have made you. And then he qualifies that even further and wrote of Abraham, who, contrary to expectation, in expectation believed, for which he would become a father of many nations, according to the declaration, thus your offspring will be, that word seed, sperma, sperm. Thus your sperm will be. Sperm can only come from Abraham's loins. Abraham's sperm can only come from Abraham's loins. Period. Paul then qualified what he meant by contrary to expectation by explaining that Abraham, and especially Sarah, should not have expected an heir from his own seed, being of such an advanced age. Having said that, Paul further explained a little farther on in the same passage, that for that reason also it was accounted to him for righteousness. So according to Paul, the faith of Abraham is fulfilled just as it is written here in Genesis, in this chapter, and in the more specific promises which follow, nearly all of which are without condition. They from of the faith are those who are the fulfillment of the promises just as it is written, the literal seed, the offspring of Abraham through Jacob Israel. That is what Abraham believed. That is how he believed it, and he was considered righteous because he believed it. While he is never recorded as having expressed the belief, he exhibited his belief in his actions. So we read in the very next verse of Genesis chapter 12, "So Abraham departed, as Yahweh had spoken unto him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran." And here we shall pause. And Yahweh willing, we shall return to our commentary and the sojourn of Abraham in the near future. Thank you for listening. Praise Yahweh, the God of Israel, and good night.